I would like to thank the organizers for the kind invitation. Although it was a torture coming here, you know, it took more than 24 hours with no sleep. I don't sleep on the plane, so I apologize if I seem a bit unenthusiastic. I'm not unenthusiastic, it's just that I'm a bit tired. But it's wonderful to be here among all of you and to have a chance to deal with some very important issues in a frank way. And my title and my theme this afternoon is the idea of Judeo-Christian-Islamic civilization. I'm suggesting that the West should think of itself not merely as Judeo-Christian, but as Judeo-Christian-Muslim or Judeo-Christian-Islamic. And I want to explain what I mean by that. The point of departure is, for me, is the issue of dialogue. And I think you're all familiar with the question of dialogue among civilizations, interfaith dialogue, interreligious dialogue. This has been around for a long time. Can you hear me at the back, by the way? No? Yeah. All right, I'll try to speak a little louder. Now, dialogue has been taking place in various forms in the Muslim world, but also in the West, for hundreds of years. Perhaps the modern form of dialogue really started in the 19th century. It has taken on a different meaning, I think, in the 20th century, and maybe a different type of urgency after 9/11. But what is common to dialogue, at least since it began in the 19th century in the West and gradually began to involve non-Christian faiths, the Jews, Muslims, but also Buddhists and Hindus. What is common about dialogue, one of the distinctive features of dialogue, which I find to be a weakness, is that it focuses on similarities. It emphasizes similarities and parallels between the religions. Now, why I say this is a weakness is because it's not the case that the discovery of similarities and parallels prevents conflict. In fact, you find in the history of wars great conflict among people who are similar. In fact, it is precisely because they are similar that they are in conflict with each other. So when people often say to me, how is it that Muslims and Jews and Christians fight with each other when there's so much they have in common? Well, it's precisely because of that, because we are competing for the same market, isn't it? We're competing in the same market. I mean, imagine Christianity was the only universal religion for 600-700 years. Judaism was not universal in the sense that it did not spread across nations, across ethnic groups, groups and so on and so forth. Hinduism was largely confined to one continent. Christianity was really the only universal religion. It must have been a shock to Christians when Islam emerged, if you think about it. Right? So ever since the emergence of Islam, you have these two religions competing for conversion, basically, right? And they were, both sides are very conscious of this. So I think dialogue with a view of establishing the similarities and parallels in terms of history, in terms of theology, in terms of values, is useful, but it can only go so far. Now, what I want to suggest is going beyond that, to think of, for the West, on the one hand, to think of itself as not merely Judeo-Christian, but also Islamic. I would also make a parallel argument that the Muslim world has to think of itself as in many ways Western. if not Christian, but in many ways Western. And I don't know if there's time, but that would actually be a separate paper. And I want to begin with a famous statement by Said Nursi. This famous statement in the Damascus sermon goes like this. Europe and Asia are pregnant with Islam and will give birth to an Islamic state. And then he goes on to say that just as the Ottoman Empire was pregnant with Europe and gave birth to a European state. Now, there are undoubtedly various ways in which we could interpret this, right? I want to offer one reading of this. I'm suggesting a particular reading of the idea Europe and America are pregnant with Islam that takes us beyond dialogue to the idea of Judeo-Christian Muslim civilization. Now, to take Nursi seriously is to examine if the West is indeed pregnant with Islam and what this pregnancy implies. Now, some of you might be familiar with the writing of a well-known Middle Eastern scholar. Is it Richard Bullitt? Richard Bullitt, right? Yes, you are familiar with him. Now, some years ago, I think it was in 2004, he came out with a book called The Case for Islamo-Christian Civilization, right? The Case for Islamo-Christian Civilization. Now, he defines this Islamo-Christian civilization as a single historical civilization that is comprised of Christian society, not all over the world, but Christian society in the West, and Muslim society in the Middle East and North Africa. And he says that this is actually a single historical civilization. And he's offering the idea, this idea of Islamo-Christian civilization in contrast to the idea of the clash of civilizations. And he's suggesting that if we think of Western Europe, Christian Western Europe and the Middle East as constituting one civilization, then we may be able to, it contributes to avoiding the clash of civilizations or the idea of the clash of civilizations. But I think the weakness in his argument is that it is based on establishing similarities between the Christian West and the Muslim Middle East. My point is that the mere existence of parallels, of similarities, does not make it, to begin with, a single civilization. The idea also of calling it a single civilization flies in the face of the believers themselves, the self-understanding of the believers, whether Christian or Muslim. But that's another issue, and it's a little complicated. Now the other problem is I'm suggesting that a more viable approach is to examine the extent to which the West thinks of itself as Islamic, the extent to which the West may consider itself Islamic, the extent to which the West sees Islam as an important element in its identity, especially when you look at the formation of Western identity over of European identity in particular over the last few hundred years. And I find this to be a more viable approach. It's important to according to this approach, it considers the Muslim world and the West to be separate civilizations. It also considers that it is more important than establishing the two as one civilization on the basis of having shared traditions and similarities or on the basis of there having been interaction between the two. More important than that is the question of whether the West can see Islam as part of its heritage. And this is not a one-sided approach, because I am also saying that the Muslim world today has to see the West as part of its heritage. But that's another question. To put it in Nursi's terms, to what extent is the West pregnant with Islam? To what extent does the West see itself as Islamic, and can we speak of the West as Judeo-Christian Islamic? The other weakness in Richard Bullitt's piece is that the Judeo part is excluded. He seems to think of it as Islamo-Christian, whereas I think the Judaic part cannot be excluded, because in the making of this, certainly of Western civilization, Judaism played an extremely important role, not only in terms of the relations between Judaism and Christianity, but also in terms of brokering, playing the role of broker between Islam and the West, as for example, between Andalusia and Europe, and between Islam and Western Christianity. Finally, I also want to point out that merely establishing, I think I mentioned the point in different terms just now, merely establishing similarities between Islam and Christianity does not avoid the idea of clash of civilizations. The idea of similarities between the two is completely and entirely compatible with the thesis of clash of civilizations. Right? It doesn't contradict it, because, as I said, clashes can occur and often do occur between entities that are very similar to each other. Now, when we begin to examine, when we try to examine this idea of Judeo-Christian Muslim civilization, I would like to approach it by way of what I call the three important themes, or three major themes of dialogue. Now, these three themes are intercivilizational encounters. These are derived from history. I derive them from history. You have intercivilizational encounters or interreligious encounters. We're talking about, of course, Islam and Christianity, Islam and Western Christianity. That leads us to the idea, as a result of these encounters, it leads us to the idea of the multicultural origins of modernity. I'll give examples of that. And the third theme is the point of view of the other. Now, let me just begin with the first theme, intercivilizational encounters. When you look at... I won't spend too much of time on this theme, because it's well known. You study the history of interaction between Islam and Western Christianity. What is very well known is the contact with the philosophical learning of the Muslims, which was transferred to Europe. You had a whole school of Latin Averroism in Europe in the Middle Ages. You also have a transfer of scientific knowledge in a number of fields, in astronomy, in mathematics, in chemistry, in physics, and so on, and so optics. There's so many examples. There's no need to go over this again. The same is true of literature, of poetry, of various art forms. The same is also true of various aspects of everyday life. For those of you who have familiar with the history of Salahuddin Ayyubi, Saladin, and in the Crusades, the Crusaders used to, when they were either captured as prisoners, or at times when they settled, when a war was over, they settled in Palestine or in Syria, and used to live among the knights, the Frankish knights, as they were called, used to live among the Muslims. They would, learn. They would pick up interesting aspects of everyday life. For example, ice cream, the idea of ice cream. For example, sherbet. sherbet comes from sharbat, right? And even syrup comes from sharab, from the Arabic word sharab. So, sugar, pepper, so many other aspects of everyday life. The cafe culture, you know, which you associate with Europe, yes? Viennese coffee, you know, outdoor cafes. Well, that's something which I think the Ottomans played a very important role in transferring that. Not intentionally, though, because when they laid Vienna to siege, they lost and they had to run away and they left bags and bags of coffee behind. Right? They captured prisoners of war. The Turks who were captured as prisoners of war taught the Viennese how to make coffee.
Vienna
rolls. Yes, that's right. Yeah. And I think for some years, the Pope, I don't remember which Pope, the name, but he declared the drink of the infidels as haram. But it proved to be so popular that he had to, you know, to revoke the... the fatwa. So, this is payback time, you know, I'm speaking to you with Islamic terminology. So, now, the idea of intercivilizational encounters, we can go beyond that to recognize that in the making of what we call modern civilization, many civilizational elements went into it. Modern civilization has multicultural origins, right? And my favorite example is the modern university, right? On the surface, the modern university looks like a European creation, which was later on transferred to America, and then from there spread to many parts of the world. But of course, there are so many basic aspects of the modern university which are derived from Islamic civilization. Now, some of the more superficial aspects are also derived from Islamic civilization. For example, your cap and gown ceremony, right? Yeah, I think you're all familiar with that, right? The whole idea of a cap and a gown has to do with the permission that a sheikh in the Sufi tradition grants to his student, his murid, when he feels that the student is now ready to pass on his teachings. So he symbolizes that permission by putting his robe over the student's back and or his cap on the student's head. Now, this permission is referred to in Arabic as ijaza. Now, in the Muslim world, in many countries, they even stop using the term ijaza, right? They use some other, well, they translate degree or they actually use licence in some of the, I think, I'm not, maybe in Egypt.
Syria.
In Syria, they use licence. But the strange thing is licence is a translation of ijaza. So ijaza means permission, license, right? So, but the translation in this way, it illustrates the historical amnesia. Muslims have forgotten where these things came from. Now, I said superficial because the cap and gown ceremony, that's a superficial, that is the influence in a superficial manner. But in more basic ways, the very foundation of the early European universities founded as they were on charitable trusts, such as, you know, universities such as Oxford, Cambridge, Bologna, and so on and so forth. These were founded on charitable trust. Now, the charitable trust is an idea that is derived from the Muslim waqf, religious endowment, right? So, there are many aspects of the structure of the university, the administration of the university, as well as the content of what was taught in the universities that come from the Muslims, right? But the Europeans developed the universities beyond what the Muslims had done over the centuries. And it needed one more important element that came from neither the Muslims or the Europeans. That was the examination system for which we have to thank the Chinese of the Tang Dynasty. the mass examination system, right? So this is just one example to show that, you know, modern institutions, modernity has got multicultural origins. Now, looking at modern society or at modernity in general as having multicultural origins goes beyond the point of similarities and parallels between civilization. So you can appreciate where I'm going with this argument. Now, I think that these examples that I'm giving are known. Some are more known, some are lesser known. A lesser known example, also connected with education, is you know, the expression, you know, when the teacher in the pre-modern Islamic institution, when he gives the permission or the ijaza to the student, the full expression is ijaza bilhaqa riwaya. Now, here we are more in the area of speculation. The speculation, in fact, the speculation is by Alfred Guillaume, an Orientalist of the last century. He said that it is likely that this expression bihaqa riwaya is the origin of the Latin term baccalaurea, right? And that speculation is strengthened by the fact that there is no Latin root for baccalaurea. If one suggests that it is a Latin word that originates with Latin, but there's no root for it. I think Guillaume was saying that the closest they could find is vaca, but that means cow. So that doesn't really has little to do with education. So baccalaurea is a corruption of bihaqa riwaya. But you know, I think when you look at history, more and more things are being discovered about the influence of Islam and the interaction between Islam and the West. Some things are much lesser known. For example, I was reading recently about the influence of Islam on Jefferson, on Thomas Jefferson, that he had bought a Quran, he had read the Quran, and he, you know, it seemed to have played a role in his understanding of the idea of multiculturalism, rights of man, the idea of pluralism, and so on and so forth. And there's been some writing on this very, very recently. So, I think, you know, we can go on with the examples, but the point is that Europe is partly defined by Islam, whether you're talking about the high philosophical tradition, which was certainly very influential in Europe on some of the, again, this is something that everyone knows, on the major European philosophers such as Thomas Aquinas, for example. But even to aspects of everyday life, we talked about ice cream and sugar and pepper and so on, to the daily lives of and experiences of people. For example, and I find this very interesting, Alibaba and the 40 Thieves, which everybody knows, it originates from an ancient Persian series of stories or tales, right? It was called, this was in pre-Islamic times, called Hezare Afsane in Persian, which means thousands of tales. And then in the Islamic period, it was added to and referred to as Alif Layla wa Layl, 1001 Nights. It went over to Europe, but it has become so much a part of European culture, you cannot say it is not European. It is foreign. No European, no American, no Westerner will say this is foreign, something different. Right? It is so much a part. If you take it away, you would be different. Right? You are defined by that. And it's a very interesting example to show that Europe is defined by something that originated from Islam, right? And I think the same thing goes for the university, the same thing goes for, you know, many aspects of culture. So I think in this sense, Europe has been pregnant with Islam for a long time. My appeal is for the West to recognize that it is more than Judeo-Christian, it is Judeo-Christian Muslim. I think when Nursi was saying that Europe is pregnant with Islam, just like the Ottomans, the Ottoman Empire was pregnant with Europe, and they were going to give birth to something, right? The two were giving birth to something. I think what he meant was that when you have a relationship of the dominant with the dominated, you're going to get a new creation, right? There's some creativity involved in that, right? Now, the question is, what do we make of this possibility of creativity? How can we, guide the process such that what we give birth to is not a monster, but is something that we can love and cherish? And I think both the West and the Muslim world has to think of it that way. To put it in other terms, if you're going to get pregnant, do it right. I said just now that I would ask the Muslims to say the same thing, to think of the same way about the West. Nursi, and I'd like to give the example of Nursi. Nursi was first and foremost an observer of the ills of Muslim society. He spent most of his time talking about Muslim society from the point of view of his own creative theology. He did have some views and some opinions about Western civilization. He spoke of the pathology of Western civilization. He didn't see it as an exclusively Western problem, because he obviously saw the interactions between the West and the Muslim world, and he saw that the pathologies of Western civilization were also to be found in the Muslim world. And he was sophisticated enough to, not to reduce the West. He made a distinction between that aspect or dimension of the West that was following through Christianity and atheistic materialist West that had turned its back on Christianity. And I think he was more sophisticated than that. He was not simply referring to an atheistic materialistic West. The way he spoke of the pathology of Western civilization, he seems to be referring to what we would today refer to in sociological jargon as anomie. The feeling of frustration, desperation, pointlessness of life that arises from the inability to satisfy unlimited desires, right? This is the way in which philosophers like Schopenhauer, Durkheim understood the term anomie. In fact, Nursi uses the term al-yas, which means despair, right? But Nursi didn't develop the argument. It was not his intention to study Western civilization, right? But to the extent that the West is an important civilization, and to the extent that the West has been having a profound influence on the Muslim world, it is necessary for Muslim scholars to study the West, to study the concept of yas, of despair, to learn Western, to master Western critiques of modernity, in order to expand on Nursi's and other scholars like Nursi's critique of the West, and to decide what from the West is worthy of being salvaged and how the West can be considered as part of the heritage of Muslim civilization in the way that I'm appealing to the West to think of Islam as part of its heritage. So now this, I think, to me, it's a very serious appeal, because how much time do I have?
Another 7 minutes.
Okay.
If you can do it.
No, it's fine. I'm concluding. It's a serious appeal because there are three imbalances in the dialogue between Islam and Christianity. When I say Christianity, I mean Western Christianity. And I mean basically Catholicism, and to some extent Protestantism. These three imbalances, the first imbalance is that in the dialogue, the Muslims are at a disadvantage because the West studies Islam, but we do not study the West. We don't study Christianity, right? Even among, you all know, for example, you have Middle Eastern studies, Islamic studies, which are very well developed in the West, right? But Western studies, American studies, Christian studies are not so well developed in the Muslim world, are not at all well developed in the Muslim world. Even among the clerics, the Catholic clergy, you have experts on the study of Islam, right? Particularly in some of the orders, like the Jesuits. The Jesuits, like Tom Michel. The Jesuits have several scholars who have PhDs in Islamic studies, who know Arabic, and who continue to do research. Tom Michel himself, Father Tom Michel, did his PhD under Fazlur Rahman in Chicago, right? And he wrote his thesis on Ibn al Arabi. He wrote it on Ibn Taymiyyah. So, but the same is not true of the Muslims in terms of developing expertise on the West, on Christianity, on Western philosophy, Christian philosophy, and so on and so forth. So this is one imbalance that has to be corrected. And I'm saying that, as I said earlier, Muslims need to study the West, they need to study Christianity, not only because the West is a dialogue partner, but we have to deal with this issue of to what extent the West is part of our heritage. The second, I'm talking about three imbalances. The second imbalance is that, which also leaves us at a disadvantage, when we dialogue with Christians, we are using, as I was mentioning earlier, conceptual vocabulary derived from Christianity. Now, this is a phenomenon that the German sociologist Joachim Mattes calls the intellectual Christianization of other religions. Right? You see, for example, if I went to Oxford University, if I was invited to Oxford University, why should we say Oxford? Let's say King's University College.
Oxford of the West.
Right. To speak about Christianity, right? And in my talk about, let's say, the history of Christianity, I did not use any Christian terminology, right? I talked about, Christian imams. I talked about, I used fatwas, as I did just now. I talk about, the Protestant mazhab, instead of saying sect.
And so, Christian
Qaeda. Yes, Christian Qaeda. That's right. Now, I would not be taken seriously because I would be regarded as a scholar who has not mastered the conceptual vocabulary of the people that I'm studying. Right? I'm not expected to accept their conceptual vocabulary, but I'm expected to know it. Right? I'm not expected to reconstruct Christianity from the point of view of Islam. But this is exactly what is being done in the study of religion. It's not only in the study of Islam, but also in the study of other religion. The classical case, the classic case is from Hinduism, where even the whole idea of a religion called Hinduism, a single entity called Hinduism, does not exist or did not exist among the so-called Hindus until Orientalists went there and said that, these people look like they all belong to one religion. And what's the name of the religion? Well, the Arabs call this land Al-Hind, as we learn from Arab geography. So let's call this religion Hinduism, right? And the fact that the different groups in India that were lumped under the category of Hinduism regard themselves as different from one another, as they are from Christians and Jews and Muslims in India, was not taken into consideration. And the proof, one of the proofs that the so-called Hindus did not regard themselves as belonging to a single entity called Hinduism or any other name, is that Al-Biruni, who studied the religions of India in the 11th century, calls the title of his refers to the what he's studying in India as the religions of India, in the plural, Adyan al-Hind. But the translator of Al-Biruni, who's German, Edward Sachau, he translates the religions of India as Hinduism. Right? The funny thing is, Sachau praises, in his translator's preface, he praises Al-Biruni for allowing his Indian subjects to speak for themselves. But Sachau does not allow Al-Biruni to speak for himself. Right? So an example in Islamic studies, I think, is this whole idea of the Protestantization of Islam, or the idea of Protestant Islam, looking at Muslim revival through the lens of the Protestant Reformation. Right? Now, I'm all for establishing parallels and similarities if they are historically borne out by the facts. Right? But if we were to, if the similarities are superficial, then we are constructing an image that is problematic. Now, thirdly, the third imbalance is that, we as Muslims are always responding to the West, right? You guys are not responding to us, right? Now, I think it's important, and I guess my paper today is asking you to respond to us, because we have done a lot of things to you, right? We have, in your historical consciousness, we are the only people, only civilizations who have conquered you, right? The Chinese, the Buddhists, the Hindus never conquered you. We are the only ones who shared historical, geographical border with you, right? We are the only other universal religion. There are many world religions, but in historical terms, the only two religions that have spread across the world, across ethnic boundaries, national boundaries, class boundaries, are Islam and Christianity, right? We have fought with you theologically. The earliest dialogues, Christian-Muslim dialogues, were actually among Arabs, or Arab-speaking Christians and Muslims, right? And then much later on, it spread to Europe. So we gave you a lot of good things as well. I mean, okay, we conquered you, we hit you over the head, you know. we also gave you some good things, you know.
Ice cream, yeah.
And we continue to do so. You know, imagine what German cuisine would be like if the Turks had not gone to Germany. At least now they can eat kebab and things like that, right? So it is necessary for you to seriously consider to what extent we are part of your tradition. And when you can acknowledge that Islam is a part of your tradition and that you are Muslim in addition to being Judeo and Christian, I think that will go a long way towards establishing, going beyond the dialogue of simply saying good things to each other and being nice to each other, but continuing to engage in conflict. And likewise, as I said, the Muslim world has to do the same. Thank you very much. Great.